This is Pirate Party Radio, episode number 2 for Thursday, November 5th, 2009. This week, disease gene patents challenged in court. 3 strikes and you're off the internet in Europe. And also, secret worldwide copyright documents leaked from meetings in Seoul, Korea.
That's why Hollywood and law enforcement have concentrated on the pirates. Before some movie previews, like this one last week in California, audience members have to pass through airport-like security. Their bags are searched for cameras, and they have to check their cell phones. A security officer inside the theater used night vision goggles looking for pirates.
What we will be putting before Parliament is a proportionate measure that will give people ample awareness and opportunity to stop breaking the rules. It will be clear to them that they have been detected, that they are breaking the law, and that they risk prosecution. If necessary, we have also made it clear that we will go further and make technical measures available, including account suspension. In this case, there will be a proper route of appeal. But it must become clear that the days of consequence-free, widespread online infringement are over.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last control force. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio. Oh my goodness, do I have some scary stories for you this week. But first off, I'm going to start with something that happened to me personally recently. I went to a concert the other day on Tuesday in locally in Vancouver. It was actually a Skinny Puppy concert, and the media police were out in full force. They had people clad in outfits that said security on it, but little did I know they were not there for the security of the public, but for the security of the band from taking pictures of the concert. Well, in line, waiting to get in to see the show, they were yelling out every 5 minutes, "There is a strict no picture policy at this show," and they weren't kidding. So we went in, and when the concert started, the usual sea of cell phone cameras popped up, balancing arms jutting out from the sea of people. Just as quickly, a coordinated team of security-clad media enforcement officers popped up. One at the back of the show, and a number at the front of the show. The one at the back of the venue could see all the screens of the cell phones and shone his flashlight on the reality-stealing perpetrators. And the guard at the front of the stage watched out for the spotlight shining on the cell phone perpetrators, and then shone his flashlight either directly into the camera or into the eyes of the suspect, rendering his recording or his vision totally useless. And quickly they were able to relegate the experience only to the memories of the audience. Now, this is the first time I'd ever seen this done at a show, and it's quite disturbing and not really surprising, both at the same time, that they were trying to prevent people with their crappy cell phone cameras with their quarter-inch diameter lenses capturing a blurry moment at the concert. It was very, very sad. So have you ever had run-ins with the media police at concerts or other venues where they're accusing you of stealing reality with your handheld recording devices? And it it's terribly difficult to separate people from their handheld devices nowadays, since you can get cell phones with audio recorders and video recorders and picture cameras on the cell phone that take stills or video. And like in the intro piece that was taken from a 60 Minutes piece that was done recently, a terribly slanted 60 Minutes piece, if you did catch it, of theaters now taking away people's cell phones and putting them in bags for you to retrieve later. Hopefully, maybe you'll get your cell phone back. This is terribly detrimental to the people trying to get your money in the first place. They're quickly convincing myself and lots of other people that really it's not worth stepping outside of your house to enjoy the media that they're trying to give to you or trying to give to you for money. But if you've ever had run-ins with the media police, drop me a line at piratepartyradio.com and just click on the submission form there with your experience or what you've had. And now on to the news. Terribly, terribly frightening. EU sanctions three strikes law rule for illegal file sharers. The party is over in Europe. The European Union has finally agreed on the last details of the telecom reform package and decided that citizens' internet access can be restricted if necessary, but only after a fair and impartial procedure, including the user's rights to be heard. Cases where it may be considered necessary to restrict internet access, including suspected terrorism, child pornography, and or the big one, of course, copyright violation. But of course, they put in the terrorism and child pornography to get everybody to agree to it, because, you know, you can't take a stand against the children. Think of the children. According to a spokeswoman for the European Parliament, the ruling will mean that the UK government's plans to introduce a three strikes rule to tackle illegal downloading, where the cost of enforcement will fall largely on the internet service providers, will go ahead as planned. How nice of them to pass this off to the internet service providers to take care of. Which just means our rates are getting jacked once again. The European Union's necessary, fair, and impartial process will be guaranteed under Business Secretary Lord Mendelssohn's proposals, who you heard in the intro of the show talking oh so nicely about what he's going to do to the internet. Because ISPs will have to send customers a series of notifications before they're able to cut off internet access. There will also be an appeals process allowing individuals to speak out against their freedom being restricted. So they can talk about it. You know, you can speak out after you've been cut off. According to the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills spokeswoman, the agreement on the telecom reform package followed 2 years of debates on how the EU telecom rules of 2002 should be reworked to make the European telecom markets more unified. Disagreements at the EU level on how to reform one of the five EU directives, which together make up the telecom rules, caused the proposals to enter the EU's conciliation procedure in September. Now, I'm going to skip down a bit. The decision last night in Brussels by the 27 MEPs and the 27 member states' representatives mean that individual internet rights can be restricted without judicial involvement, a process described by human rights organizations as removing safeguards that protect citizens' freedoms. Now, this is the government taking the internet as a toy again and not taking it seriously. We need the internet nowadays. If you want to function in society, it is completely ingrained in the citizens' minds. The internet is something that they can't live without. If you've ever worked at a help desk and somebody's internet is not working, they freak the hell out. They cannot be without the internet for a moment. And I'm the same way. It would be very difficult for me to function without the internet. Case in point, me doing this radio show. So now it's on the ISPs to determine whether you are going to be on the internet or not. Without any judicial rule, you're just off the internet, your name goes on a blacklist, and you'll be allowed no more. That part of the world is gone for you. Find a new way. Maybe you'll have to go through a third party and talk to a friend to get them to get your email and print it out for you and bring it over to you because, you know, you can't go on the internet. People equate computers to internet. They don't talk about computers anymore. They talk about internet boxes, internet access gateways. It's ingrained in us. It's part of us. This is going to be taking it away, and we need to get countries to ratify that the internet is an essential part of a human right. It should be a human right because it's essential to our survival nowadays. If you want to function in society, if you want to make money, if you want to advance. I believe it was Finland recently that guaranteed internet access for all of its citizens. Now, I'm not sure how it jives with this law, how you can be kicked off and be guaranteed internet access. So we'll have to see how that plays out as time progresses and people start getting kicked off the internet forever. The next news story is even scarier. This was sent in by No Deal. Secret documents from the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement have been leaked. This is from TrueSlant.com. Anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, the ACTA. Remember that acronym, ACTA. Negotiations continued yesterday, November 3rd, in Seoul, Korea. And while no text has officially been released, rumors of U.S. secret ACTA documents have raised serious concerns. Later yesterday afternoon, Boing Boing reported that the following excerpts from the supposedly leaked secret document that ISPs have to proactively police copyright on user-contributed material. This means that it will be impossible to run a service like Flickr or YouTube or Blogger since hiring enough lawyers to ensure that the mountain of material uploaded every second isn't infringing will exceed any hope of profitability. It would shut every kind of user-generated content site down. And guess what? Those are the most popular sites on the internet now. Soon you'll have to have a team of lawyers for your own website to post it on your site. And then, not even that, you get it approved through your lawyers, submit it to the ISP, and go in to a moderated style of, you know, submittal approval process. So you submit it, then the ISP would be able to look at it, you know, review it for a week or a month or so, however long their list is, and then get around to looking at your website content, and then maybe approve it. Does this sound anything like a repressive government regime, such as how you have to send mail in China, where the post office looks through your mail first, and then you get to seal it and put a stamp on it and give it to them? A little bit. Second point, that ISPs have to cut off the internet access of accused copyright infringers or face liability. This means that your entire family could be denied to the internet and hence to civic participation, health information, education, communications, and the means of earning a living. If one member is accused of copyright infringement without access to trial or counsel. This is accused copyright infringers. Soon there will be people accusing everyone everywhere anonymously or even non-anonymously that they're copyright infringing. And 1, 2, 3, you're out of there. No trial, you're gone. ISPs have to shut it down, shut you down, because you've been accused of it. And thirdly, that the whole world must adopt U.S. styles, notice and takedown rules that require ISPs to remove any material that is accused, again, without evidence or trial, of infringing copyright. This has proven a disaster in the U.S. and other countries, where it provides an easy means of censoring material just by accusing it of infringing copyright. This is very dangerous. This provides a chilling effect on everything. Everything on the internet. All you have to do is point a finger and say, "Witch!" And it's off the internet. Also, mandatory prohibitions on breaking DRM, even if doing so for a lawful purpose, to make a work available for disabled people for archive preservation, or because you own the copyright work that is locked up with DRM. I am a producer of movies and music and things like that. Luckily, I release my own stuff, and it does not get hampered by DRM. I've put out DVDs, none of which have contained the CSS code. Unfortunately, Blu-ray, at this moment, if you're going to get it produced at a copy house for that makes Blu-ray discs, you have to pay the fee to put their copy protection on it, because it just won't play without the copy protection. Professor Michael Geis, Canadian Research Chair in the Internet and E-Commerce Law at the University of Ottawa, writes that the draft text is modeled on the U.S.-South Korea Free Trade Agreement. He says the principles in the documents will include requirements to hold third party liable for copyright infringement. That means no more safe harbor rules for ISPs. That means they're going to be liable for things that go through them. Another chilling effect. Now, ISPs will have to lock down everything that goes through them, put massive restrictions, keyword searches, clamp down on protocols, on ports. It's going to be web access only through, you know, make it so simple and dumbed down that the internet is completely useless. And Gizmodo reports that the U.S. is pushing for a new global IP enforcement regime. Countries who sign up to the U.S.-promoted plan will have to force ISPs to proactively police copyright on user-generated content, cut off those accused, and put gradual response clauses in customer contracts, etc., etc., etc. And she goes on to say, if you are a smart and important politico, don't become an active member country. Let's hope that the people who keep the internet alive will somehow be more powerful than the mass of silver-haired men in striped suits. Or perhaps it's time for us to build a pirated internet 2.0. Well, if this does happen, that's what's going to happen. If the internet is so hobbled by these rules that countries are enacting, there's going to be a subversive movement, either layered upon atop the existing internet, or a new structure will be built underneath by non-governmental controlled bodies, and everybody will hop on that. You can try and make it into something that the corporations want or dream of in their wet dreams, but it's not going to happen for the people that don't want it to happen. All you're doing is pushing people underground, and unfortunately, the masses are not going to be pushed underground because they don't have the knowledge or the choice or the information accessible to them. They're going to have to surf the Disney web pages. They're going to be forced into that, not knowing the alternatives. So it's all about education, all about showing people what is happening in the world and showing them the alternatives, or how to fight, or how to inform their government that this is not what the population wants. Because if enough people stand up and say, I don't want this, it happens. The government does listen to masses of people because they don't want a revolt on their hands. They want to slide these in nice and simple in the middle of the night in other countries around the world. In privacy news, a three-hit punch, starting with the first news stories. Feds can search your email without notice, judge rules. This is from PC World. The opinion by federal judge Michael Mossman, handed down in Portland, Oregon, involves a case in which the government has probable cause for a search and asked Google to provide 9 months of a Gmail subscriber's emails seeking evidence of the crime. Furthermore, the feds asked that the search warrant be sealed and that the user shouldn't be told what was happening. Gmail isn't the only email provider that might face this situation. Other services, including Microsoft's Hotmail and AOL, say that in their usage terms that they'll share information with the government when required by warrant or court order. What's shocking is that this could be happening without your knowledge. Mossman's ruling reversed an earlier decision that the user must get a receipt after the government rifles through email. Though he says electronic communications are protected by the Fourth Amendment, which guards against unreasonable search and seizure, those protections don't apply to the email user. If the government takes a look at your email, the obligation to disclose what was searched ends at the internet service provider. Mossman gives this analogy. If the government seizes a package by FedEx, the recipient and sender don't have to be told, as long as the FedEx gets a copy of the warrant. Also, Mossman wrote that the government didn't take any property, so to speak, because the email can be viewed from anywhere. The nut of the issue is that Mossman doesn't like an email to personal property stored at home. If the suspect leaves private documents at his mother's house and the police obtain a warrant to search his mother's house, they need only to provide a copy of the warrant and a receipt to the mother, even though she is not an owner of the documents, he writes. However, Mossman writes that the law remains unclear whether information stored online is like a virtual home. I think enough people assume so that we need legislation to iron this out. Another example where people are not educated in how where email is and how the internet works. If you have your email at Gmail or Hotmail and you view it online and you don't download it to your own PC, it's not yours. It's not there. It's still sitting at Google. It's still there for anybody to take a look at. And unless these ISPs or providers of email are clear in their regulations of storage of email and how long they keep it, even if you do retrieve it, you don't even know where your email ends up or how long it's going to stay there. Case in point, Facebook. If you delete your account, your account actually isn't deleted. They keep it for a while, just in case you want to activate it again. Canada's trying to pass laws or trying to come to agreements with Facebook so that it's more upfront about what Facebook does with your data. And this kind of thing should happen more and more with providers of email and providers of content for you. Anywhere you put in personal information. Never assume your information is personal. Assume everything that goes over the internet is public because it is, unless it is encrypted with something that has been unbroken. And even then. The second part to this triple hit is warrantless wiretap lawsuit. This was sent in by this was off news off Google. Attorney General Eric Holder says a lawsuit in San Francisco over warrantless wiretap threatens to expose ongoing intelligence work and must be thrown out. In making the argument, the Obama administration agreed with the Bush's administration position on the case, but insists that it came to the decision differently. A civil liberties group criticized the move Friday as a retreat from promises President Barack Obama made as a candidate. Holder's effort to stop the lawsuits makes it the first time the administration has tried to invoke the state secret privilege under a new policy it launched last month, designated to make such a legal argument more difficult. Under the state secret privilege, the government can have a lawsuit dismissed if hearing the case would jeopardize national security. The Bush's administration invoked the privilege numerous times in lawsuits over post-9/11 programs, but the Obama administration recently announced that the only a limited number of senior Justice Department officials would be able to make such decisions. It also agreed to provide confidential information to the courts in such cases. Under the new approach, an agency trying to keep such information secret would have to convince the Attorney General and a panel of Justice Department lawyers that its release would compromise national security. Holder said that in the current case, the review process convinced him that there is no way for a case to move forward without jeopardizing ongoing intelligence activity that we rely upon to protect the safety of the American people. So, warrantless wiretap lawsuits are being thrown out in court because it jeopardizes national security. But we won't know what national security it jeopardizes because it's being thrown out of court. So, it's secrets protected by secrets. It's hard to fight that kind of thing. It's kind of a catch-22. It's circular logic. It's impossible to break that. We're not going to tell you about this case because we can't tell you about this case because it's a secret protecting secrets. So nobody will ever know, and you can't find out because you can't know. It just doesn't make sense. The third part of the story is the NSA to store a yottabyte of your phone calls, emails, and other Big Brother-y stuff. This was sent in by Lensman. This is off Gizmodo.com. In Utah, the National Security Agency is building a $2 billion storage facility that will house and analyze all forms of electronic communication, a potential yottabyte of everyone's formerly personal data. So how big is a yottabyte? Well, it's big. There are 10,000 gigabytes in a terabyte, 1,000 terabytes in a petabyte, 1,000 petabytes in an exabyte, 1,000 exabytes in a zettabyte, 1,000 zettabytes in a yottabyte. In terms of data on a human scale, a yottabyte is nearly infinite. To be fair, a yottabyte is just one estimate generated by a Pentagon think tank. The facility could hold a mere hundreds of petabytes. Either way, the prospect is unsustainable, as it is frightening. This one facility will burn through as much electricity as the entirety of Salt Lake City. So, your private information is not private anymore. They can get it from ISPs without letting you know. They will mirror the whole internet, and they will tape your phone calls and store them on massive hard drives to be searched later at a whim whenever they like to find something on you. The subversive. The person that's stirring up trouble. What can we dig up on him that's completely legalized because we've made it legalized? You're guilty before proven innocent on the hard drive. This is completely frightening. That everything is stored on you. You have to assume and skulk around in the dark that everything is public now. You're stored on video cameras, your email is stored, everything is being recorded. You are being watched 24 hours a day. And I'm sure this radio show will be on the hard drive somewhere, immortalized on the government's database. Next door, DVR. Once TV's mortal foe, now helps ratings, sent in by DC. In what may seem a media business version of the Stockholm Syndrome, television network executives have fallen in love with a former tormentor, the digital video recorder. Yes, that thing they fought, just like they fought every advancement in technology, they finally figured out that it's actually helpful. The reason is not simply that more households own DVRs, 33% compared with 28% at this point in 2008, helping some marginal shows become hits. It is also that more people seem to content to sit through the commercials than networks once thought. These factors combined mean DVR ratings now add significantly to live ratings, thus to ad revenue. The DVR was going to kill television, said Andy Donchin, director of media investment for the ad agency. It hasn't. Against almost every expectation, nearly half of all people watching delayed shows are still slouching on their couches, waiting, watching messages about movies, cars, and beer. According to Nielsen, 46% of viewers 18 to 49 years old for all four networks taken together are watching commercials during playback, up slightly from last year. Why would people pass on the opportunity to skip through to the next chunk of program content? The most basic reason, according to Brad Adgate, the senior vice president for research at Horizon Media, a media buying firm, is that the behavior has gone underpinned television since its invention still persists to a large degree than expected. It's still a passive activity. And those passive viewers are watching in numbers big enough to turn some hits into even bigger moneymakers. Some middling success, How I Met Your Mother on CBS, into healthier profit centers, and seemingly endangered shows into possible survivors. 2 years ago, in a seismic change from past practice, Nielsen started measuring television consumption by the so-called Commercial Plus 3 ratings, which measured viewing for commercials and shows that are watched either live or playback on digital video recorders within 3 days. This replaced the use of program ratings. At the time, network executives fiercely resisted change, fearing they would never get credit for recorded shows because viewers would skip through all the commercials. But figures show otherwise. So they're actually learning that technology can help them. Instead of missing shows and not seeing them live because they're doing something else that day, people can record their favorite shows and watch them later. So people are probably actually watching more shows because they have the accessibility to watch more shows. What I think, and it's in their best interest, is to actually cut down on the number of commercials, cut them down to one commercial, so that when you get to the end of the first segment of the television show, there's a commercial there. But it's too bothersome to actually skip the commercial because you could make it a random amount of time, random amount of length the commercial can be, so you don't know how far to skip, and you'll end up watching it anyway. Because when I'm watching my DVR, I skip through the commercials, like a lot of people do. They said more than half of people skip through the commercials. But you know what? I have to see the last commercial, because the skipping function and commercial lengths are uneven. So you skip, skip, skip. Oh, there's the show. Skip back one. You see the last 10, 20 seconds of the last commercial, and you're forced to see it anyway. So, you know, you sit through it and you don't fast forward it because, you know, it's too hard to do it perfectly. So therefore, you see the last commercial. So why not just reduce it to one commercial and up the rates four times the amount? You must make the same amount of revenue. People are guaranteed to watch it. And I've noticed this trend happening on the internet when they're showing television shows for free on the internet. They just give one commercial. Next news story sent in by Tong Chop. File sharers are big spenders too. This is from BBC. People who download music illegally also spend an average of £77 a year buying it legitimately, a survey has found. Those who claim not to use peer-to-peer file sharing, such as the Pirate Bay, spend a yearly average of just £44. Almost 1 in 10 of those questioned, aged between 16 and 50, say they downloaded music illegally. That seems a little low. 1 in 10, but they did go up to 50. It's quite a range. However, 8 out of 10 of that group also bought CDs, vinyl, and MP3s. A total of 1,008 people in the UK took part of an online poll commissioned by researchers Demos. Half of the group, 50%, accessed music officially via YouTube, and 22% listened to internet radio. Napster, once a pioneer of file music sharing, was used by just 4%, with 21% saying they had not heard of it. Napster? Well, it's been gone for a long time. Of course, it's legitimized. Music streaming services Spotify was used by 9% of the group, most of whom have not signed up for the paid-for premium service. However, it was rated highly for being easy to use, convenient, and providing access to a wide variety of music. 75% of 16 to 24-year-olds are prepared to pay for MP3s. The optimum price for the survey of the group as a whole was 45 pence for an individual track, with just 2% saying they would pay more than £1. Sorry. Current chart toppers, blah, 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 blah. So they're learning slowly that they can make money on the internet, and that they also can make money by free access to music. And by providing free access to music, like they've done for many years since the invention of radio, by giving away music for free because you can listen to the radio for free over the airwaves, which is essentially an ad service, move that service onto the internet. Make music accessible, easily accessible for people to listen to. And once they hear your music, they will seek out more. If you make it more accessible, there's more music for people to hear. The problem is that they're stuck in the mindset. The big corporation, musical corporation, stuck in the mindset that they don't want the diversity of music. They don't want the choice. They want you to go to the top 10 artists that make the most money and direct you to those artists rather than diversify. Have 1,000 artists and people buying evenly amongst this 1,000 artists rather than going to the 10 artists and dumping their whole pocketbook. They don't understand that there is a limit. People have a limited amount of entertainment money. Say they have $40 in their wallet. They're going to spend it on entertainment. Now, how you get that entertainment dollars are up to you. So you've got to be clever about it. And this is a good example of how to get those dollars out of people's pockets. This was sent in by Kevin, posted by Kevin Ottawa in the PPCA forums. Judge OK's challenge to human gene patents. A federal judge ruled Monday that a lawsuit can move forward against the Patent and Trademark Office and the research company that was awarded exclusive rights to human genes known to detect early signs of breast and ovarian cancer. This is a story of patents gone wild. The first-of-its-kind lawsuit by the American Civil Liberties Union and the Public Patent Foundation and at the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law claims that the patents violate free speech by restricting research. U.S. District Judge Robert W. Sweet of New York, in a ruling that the case may proceed to trial, noted that the litigation might open the door to challenge of a host of other patented genes. About one-fifth of the human genome is covered under patent application and claims. Did you hear that? One-fifth of your body is under patent laws. People can't do research under you because a corporation owns you. One-fifth of you. The challenges to the patents in suit raise questions about the difficult legal dimensions concerning constitutional protection over the information that serves as our genetic identities and the need to adopt policies that promote scientific innovation and biomedical research. The widespread use of gene sequence information as the foundation for biomedical research means that the resolution of these issues will have far-reaching implications, not only for gene-based healthcare and the healthcare of millions of women facing the specter of breast cancer, but also for the future course of biomedical research. Now, is it in the humanity's best interest to lock down our genetic information and award it to corporations? Or is it in our best interest in the advancement of medical research to have this kind of information open to all so we can cure society's ills? I vote on the latter half. Now, I understand that corporations have invested millions of dollars to uncover these truths about our genetic information and our bodies and how this works. Well, I've got a solution for that. Just as the International Space Station is a collaborative effort of the world's scientific community, why can't genetic research be a worldwide effort of the scientific community, where everyone can reap rewards when research is being done to help further humanity's case for survival in the future? I can't see why people can't wrap their head around this. But it's the corporations that drive this kind of litigation and court system that lock down genetic information. One-fifth of the genetic information of the human body. How can you copyright something that you didn't invent? How not copyright patent something that you didn't invent? That is not a unique or new way of looking at things. It is something that has already existed. There is prior art. Millions of years of prior art. Our genetic information has been there forever. How can you patent something that has always been there? Well, not always, but, you know, millions of years. Pirate Bay closure sparks file sharing boom, sent in by DC. This is from pcpro.co.uk. The temporary closure of the Pirate Bay had the unforeseen side effect of forcing torrent shares underground and causing a 300% increase in sites providing access to copyright files, according to McAfee. I guess McAfee tracks these kinds of things. In August, Swedish courts ordered that all traffic be blocked from Pirate Bay, but any hopes of scotching the piracy of music, software, and films over the web vanished as copycat sites sprung up and the content took on a life of its own. This was a true cloud computing effort, the company said in a threats report for the third quarter. Threats report? Why is this labeled under threats report in McAfee? the masses stepped up to make this database of torrents available to others. The Pirate Bay is just a redirect site to lead people to sources where they can get media and other files, McAfee security analyst Greg Dace told PC Pro. Once it was temporarily shut down, these people still wanted the torrents, so they went elsewhere. And that meant lots of other sites popped up to take advantage. We saw a 300% increase in sites hosting and distributing movies and software. According to Day, in the days prior to the shutdown, treasure hunters and anonymizing software to gain access and copy the indexes that the Pirate Bay used to redirect users to other computers hosting torrents. Once the index data was in the public domain, open source code was available to anyone who wanted to help with redistribution of torrents. While the Pirate Bay was offline, there were four times as many sites offering access to the torrents. The Pirate Bay example shows how difficult it is to stop the data once it's on the web. The report says a website can be shut down, but anyone who has accessed the content may still be able to redistribute it. And that is the crux of the argument. The Torrent Bay, the Pirate Bay, is not the ones distributing the content. They are merely showing that people are trading this kind of information back and forth. It is free-flowing on the internet. You can shut down Pirate Bay, but it will spring seven more heads, which will provide more access to the content. And this is what the media distributors don't understand. If they took on the role of the Pirate Bay, if they were the distributors, if they were the official houses where people went to get the movies online, where there has previously been a wide gap in this realm, and Pirate Bay is merely filling that gap, filling that need that people are searching for on the internet, an easy and cheap, effective way to access the media that they are yearning for. Now, if there is a massive collaboration of easily accessible, non-DRM'd, and inexpensive place to get all the media that you wanted, wouldn't you go there? With a place with properly labeled media files, covers, liner notes, lyrics, available in different sizes, massive size, small size, sizes that fit on your portable devices. If something so easy and so widespread would be accessible, you think people wouldn't go there? Look at the success of iTunes. Take that and extrapolate that without DRM, with more information, and people will go there. Build it and they will come. And the submitter DC notes this is an example of Gilmore's Law, where the net interprets censorship as damage and routes around it. And this is also what has happened. If you shut something down and there is a need for it, people won't stop looking for it. They'll just go elsewhere for it. They'll build places for this content that has now been taken offline. People don't all of a sudden go, oh, I guess it's gone now. Oh, well, I'm just going to turn off my computer and go outside. No, it doesn't happen that way. And the Pirate Bay knows this, and they made a complete index of their site and shared it with the community. So in case it gets shut down, somebody can instantly open another one up. And it routes around it. Next story, Pirate Privacy Watchdog OKs see-through scanners. This is posted by Anthony in the PPCA forums. This is from Yahoo.com News. Airport scanners that can see through the clothes of travelers have received the blessing of Canada's privacy czar. Chantelle Bernier, the Assistant Federal Privacy Commissioner, said Friday the National Air Security Agency has successfully answered her office's questions about the project. The system, tested in British Columbia at the Kelowna Airport, allows a screening officer to see whether someone is carrying plastic explosives or other dangerous items. The proposal has stirred controversy because the scanner produces a three-dimensional outline of a person's naked body. It is a very touchy issue, and we have addressed it with exactly that level of care, Bernier told a gathering of security officials and academics. Under the plan approved by the privacy chief, the officer would view the image in a separate room and never see the actual traveler. except in three-dimensional form without their clothes. Only people singled out for an extra screening would be scanned, and they would have the option of getting a physical pat-down instead. Bernier said the holographic image generated by the scanner makes it difficult to identify the traveler's face. You would not know who it is, even if you knew the person in line, she said at the annual meeting of the Canadian Association for the Security and Intelligence Studies. We've actually tested it. In addition, the image would be deleted the moment the person leaves the screening portal. In our view, these privacy safeguards meet the test for the proper reconciliation of public safety and privacy. The Canadian Air Transport Security Authority has done a thorough threat assessment that reveals a need to search passengers for weapons that might elude a conventional metal detector. Giving a traveler who undergoes secondary screening the choice of either a full body scan or a pat down reduces the sense of invasion posed by the new tool, Bernier added. So they're giving the option right now. They're getting people used to the idea of getting completely scanned naked and showing their privates to an officer. And this officer is just some random dude who works at the airport. This is not a police officer. This is some guy who's looking at naked bodies all day. And let's try and thwart this. If you are given the option, please take the pat down, and don't walk through the 3D body scanner. It's a bit of an invasion of privacy in my eyes. I don't know about you. And Pirate Party news: Pirate Party gets a second seat in European Parliament, sent in by R3 Gista. TorrentFreak.com had this story. With the Lisbon Treaty being signed by all European Union member states, the Pirate Party has gained another seat in the European Parliament. The second Pirate Party seat will be occupied by the 22-year-old Amelia Enderstadter, who will become the youngest member of the European Parliament. With more than 7% of the vote, the Swedish Pirate Party secured a seat in the European Parliament in June, and the possibility of gaining another if the Lisbon Treaty was signed by all member states. The Lisbon Treaty was ratified yesterday by Václav Klaus, president of the Czech Republic, who was the last to sign the document. Ironically, the Pirate Party was against the Lisbon Treaty, which now has doubled the number of seats the party has in the European Parliament. The newly gained seat will be awarded to Amelia Enderstadter, who will become the youngest member of the European Parliament. In order to free up time for her political career, Melian recently has decided to quit economics and Spanish at the Lund University in Sweden. Besides fighting for fairer and more sensible copyright legislation, she will also be able to spend time on education and the development of Europeans' knowledge economy. The Parliament needs to be going for a sustainable knowledge economy, and that's where I come into play, Amelia told Torrent Freak. Amelia will officially take her seat in Brussels on December 1st, where she'll be joining Christian Engström. The two will have plenty of work to do in the years to come, countering the growing influence from pro-copyright lobby groups. So congratulations, Amelia. In our free media and music section, Triad. Triad is one of the world's first virtual bands, formed across the ocean and spawned by the combination of OpSound and Creative Commons. A growing international community of Triad members collaborate online, building a body of open source music which can be freely shared, copied, and remixed. Welcome to this new age of renaissance. Triad welcomes any and all artist submissions. So check out their website, triad.org, and download to your heart's content. And if you have a site with free music or media on it that you'd like to support, submit it at piratepartyradio.com and just post it in the form there and click submit. Now, this is my closing track. Dan Bull, Dear Lily. We'll end off the show with a track from Dan Bull called Dear Lily, about Lily Allen, a British musician who in September of 2009, Allen stated that she sees no way that she could ever make a profit making new records. Aww. She also announced that she has no plans to make another album, and she is not renewing her record contract. who I say good riddance. If profit is the only motivator for musicians to make music, I wouldn't mind at all if all in the same mindset got out of the game and left the people who are motivated by making great music to pick up her slack. Bye-bye, Lily. And there's another level to this, though. From her Wikipedia entry, after the British government's plan to implement a three-strikes policy for file-sharing copyright infringement, Lily Allen came out in strong support for disconnecting offenders. Creating a blog entitled It's Not All Right Against File Sharing, it subsequently came to light that she had copied text directly from the Tech Dirt website of an interview with 50 Cent. This led to an exchange on the internet which culminated in accusations being made that Miss Allen had infringed on other artists' copyright by creating mixtapes early in her career that she then made available via her website. So she's already got two strikes and we're waiting for a third on Lily Allen. And if you have news stories that you'd like to hear on the show, submit them through the forum on the website piratepartyradio.com. And I'll leave you with a quote from a Robert Heinlein book called Lifeline, written in 1938. Before we leave this matter, I wish to comment on a theory implied by you, Mr. Weems, when you claimed damage to your client. There has grown up in the minds of certain groups in this country the notion that because a man or corporation has made profit out of the public for a number of years, the government and the courts are charged with the duty of guaranteeing such profit in the future, even in the face of changing circumstances and contrary public interest. This strange doctrine is not supported by statute nor common law. Neither individuals nor corporations have any right to come into court and ask that the clock of history be stopped or turned back for their private benefit. That is all. Until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.
Dear Lily Allen, remember when you pretended, Lily, that you were truly independent, Lily, faking like you made it. All alone, but you were legally with Regal, part of Parlophone. Oh yeah. So when you lectured me, I thought I'd file share my thoughts on your MP3, Lily. Now first I must sing your praises. I love your singing, but I'll just say this. I saw on your MySpace page you're saying file sharing the new ice age, but the industry's a recent innovation. Music's been alive, thriving since cavemen. Folk songs so long have had a place in communities that you should be amazed at it. Then one day came intellectual property, meaning if I think a thought, you can't copy me. And if honesty's the best policy, I'd say songs are better off without this monopoly. It'd blatantly be a major fail if they patented the major scale. And downloads don't equate to sales, so taking them away won't make me pay up. Just precludes me from sending your tunes to my friends, so we all lose in the end. You lose potential fans and we lose respect for the fact that you're desperate for cash. But what do you expect from the lass who's collecting a fat bank check from the man? While her fans are collecting the glasses for minimum wage they'll spend on her tracks.
Dear Lily, why are you being this silly? You're sincerely that boring. Dear Lily, why are you being this silly? You're sincerely that boring.
Now please don't be offended, Lily. I think your new CD's splendid, Lily. Everybody's at it and it's not fair. I could say the fear was him, but he wasn't there. So let's go back to the start before 22. All music's in the public domain, so fuck you. It's never the amateurs that reckon it's damaging us. It's the major label saying it's fatal, like when Napster had to pack up by Metallica. The tables turn now, the labels churn out a new Jezebel internet televangelist. And she's fit with a manuscript that was actually written by Mr. Michael Masnick. Can you get the irony? And by the by, Lily, I like this beat. I hope you don't mind me thieving, cause even doing a cover song's decried as stealing. But it's alright still for you to plagiarise and preach it. Don't you believe it's maybe time to rethink, Lily? Put music back in the hands of the people. Make the majors and amateurs equal. If anything, labels strangle the freedom you claim they're saving by banning this evil. That's the actual reason you're seeing. Please don't compare sharing to stealing. I've not took anything off you. I'm just spreading love for what you do. Downloaded your songs for free, then I bought my mom your CD. She likes it too, she keeps telling me. All because I pirated an MP3.
Now I got Matt Bellamy, telling me I'm not a fan, I'm the enemy. That's amusing, I'm paid enough to see news in my time, I could buy them a museum. Did you see him on the program miming? Yeah, the pirates are killing live gigs. Maybe we should have a band CDs appeal, then people are paid to see bands for real. Just your sale.